Hi, and welcome to the VFX show number 21, and we're doing Spider-Man 3. And I have on the line Kenji. Hey, man, how are you?
Not too bad. Actually doing pretty good today.
Last time I saw you was actually in San Francisco when I dropped in the offices there, and you were pretty flat out. But how are you going at the moment?
Good. I got a good night's sleep last night, actually. We got through one of our production runs, and we're moving on to the next one now.
Excellent, excellent. So what did you think of the movie?
Story-wise, I didn't like it necessarily as well as the second one. But visual effects are some great visual effects in this one.
Yeah.
Especially some of the character stuff. I did find like Sandman to be very compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that the character animation was the thing that really separated this film out from the bunch. I mean, apart from the obvious, you know, big budget, summer blockbustery kind of thing, it was in fact just some superb character animation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing that actually for the character animation I found interesting too is that when the movie first started, some of the Spider-Man animation to me felt it was almost not quite up to the same level as the first one, I thought. But as the story started evolving and the movie went along, I noticed that seemingly the character animation got better as it went along too.
So for me, the outstanding shot of the whole film actually, or the sequence, was the shot of Sandman when he's first warming up. I just thought that was spectacular.
Yeah, no, it was quite impressive. I've seen the movie twice now, and they spent a long time on that scene in the film, and I felt that they justly did so, because that is such a beautiful scene with the sand grains forming and how the character comes together. It really is a spectacular visual effects scene.
I mean, if you look at it from a character animation point of view, it's one thing to say, well, let's animate an inanimate object, and, you know, we've all been impressed with very good character animation that's taken something that's otherwise, you know, not very, for example, it doesn't have personality because it's not human, and giving it personality just through animation. But it's another thing to do that to a large lump of sand that's constantly falling away and kind of shifting. It was pretty spectacular, actually.
No, it was very much so. In fact, I was reading some of the background behind that, and they spent like 3 years trying to come up with the Sandman effect, it sounds like. So, and I think that those 3 years really paid off. The other thing I found interesting is that they couldn't use a traditional character rigging system because it is a character made up of particles. So I don't think they used a traditional IK kind of system for it.
No, I was lucky enough to sit down yesterday, actually, and chat to Chuck McIlvan, who is the technical animation supervisor at Sony Imageworks, did the digital character animation pipeline stuff there. And he was explaining that the complexity really is one of dealing between effectively fluid simulations or simulation stuff, character animation, rigging, and, of course, just the need to have a very organic, constantly changing piece of geometry. And it was a very interesting mix, if you think about it, between what they had to do as sims and what they had to do as sort of art-directed simulations, and then finally what they just had to do is straight character animation on top. And it's combining all of those things together that I think was just superb.
Yeah, no, it's amazing.
Though, interestingly, he said that at the very beginning of that shot, they were individually animating grains of sand.
Individual grains of sand?
Absolutely.
They were animating?
They were keyframing individual grains of sand at the beginning of that shot. By the end, it was pretty much down to simulations and the tools that they developed. But yeah, it was an astonishing amount of work.
Well, it was definitely a spectacular scene. And actually, in my opinion, anytime they had the Sandman in the movie, even the sand cloud effect, when the Sandman would turn into this nebulous cloud flying through the sky, I thought was done very well.
Yeah, and that's a lot of particle animation. I mean, even for Sony Imageworks, which, let's face it, is one of the biggest effects houses now in the world, that's a heck of a lot of stuff to compute.
Yeah, no, I remember back in the day when I was helping a group look at building tornadoes using particle systems. We were pushing the systems pretty hard at that point, and I was very impressed with the particles they were using for Sandman in those scenes. So,
One of my favorite effects, talking about just sort of general Sandman ones, just for sheer clever inventiveness, is you know the shot, you've probably seen it, quite a few publications have run it, of Spidey actually punching the Sandman and going through his chest. And I just love the fact that they used a stuntman who was an amputee to play Spidey for that. So you could actually get the thump onto the other actor's chest, but without, of course, needing the inconvenience of punching right through his chest. And then just put a digital fist on the other side. And I thought that was a great piece of lateral thinking.
No, and it was actually a spectacular scene. In fact, that was one of those scenes to me in the film that I could watch a couple times, just because it is such a nice sequence of, you know, the physical contact of it, yet seeing the particles going flying out his back and the fist going through. It was really a great scene.
Now, the other one that was in the same vein of character animation is the goop, the black goo that is obviously
Venom.
Venom, yeah. Because the character animation of that pre-taking over Spidey had its own, you know, challenges, given that I understand the director didn't want it to look like an octopus or an insect or a spider. So they had to come up with a pretty unique and original look for the way that stuff would sort of, you know, move. And again, not particularly traditional character animation to be dealing with lumps of sort of what was almost like a oily, I don't know what you'd call it, really.
Well, it's kind of, it reminded me in some ways of the, for those that are X-Files fans, the black oil from X-Files, but had a very sinewy effect, almost like there was like almost tendons underneath it, but had that fluid effect still. So it was very impressive.
Actually, it's perceptive of you to say that, because the thing that Chuck said that when we were talking to him was that they eventually went for a hand-like sort of concept. It was like a claw almost, to be the only sort of accurate way they could get some kind of threatening movement out of it that also seemed to have intelligence without it looking like, as I said, like an octopus or a spider. And so that tenuous and tendon kind of thing, I think was very much a deliberate move on behalf of the animators.
Well, and I think they pulled it off quite spectacularly too. Again, those two characters in the film really made the film for me.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was interesting though, wasn't it, that for a film that obviously could have done an enormous amount of digital stuff in every respect, they actually shot quite a lot of traditional background plates, and a lot of the scenes that you might have thought they were digital buildings were actually live action elements that have been photographed.
Right. Well, I was even reading that they did a lot of sequences where they'd start digital, they'd go real, and then they go back digital, or vice versa. Only some parts of it were digital, like the actor's head was real, but the body was digital, or things like that. So that was impressive, definitely, that they used so much practical actually in the film.
Yeah, it was, I think. And there was a huge amount of second unit stuff going on. A friend of mine at Sony Image Works, she was doing second unit photography stuff or visual effects for that. And yeah, they were shooting tons of stuff to feed in, and they used, of course, the Spidey cam, the wired camera rig. Now that'd be a rush to use.
Oh yeah, most definitely. I think that probably takes some time to develop those skills a bit.
Yeah, I just sort of love to have the resources that a film like that would have, because obviously a huge film for Sony, and one that's a very important franchise, and so. But you can imagine when you're trying to work out how to approach something like that, it's the logistics of it must be phenomenal.
Oh, most definitely. Well, I was even reading that I think they were looking for a city where they could actually shut down several square blocks to film the practicals for the bank car chase. And I think Cleveland was one of the few cities that would let them close down a multi-block area of the city to film the movie in.
Yeah, if you watch some of the background footage, like I was sitting there with a director, and we were just thinking, like in even a passing shot, the number of extras and directed extras that were, you know, in a shot in the streets would just be huge. It's astonishing. I mean, in terms of shot count, it wasn't that big a, you know, raw shot count film. It was like 930 shots, I think. But in terms of complexity of those shots, oh my God, it's just extraordinary.
Well, the one that, speaking of complexity, that got me was actually the sequence where, right after the bank robbery, I think it was, where Sandman goes, actually, I think right after he comes out of the sand truck, where he goes down the street, and it looks like it's a practical shot of this long city block where cars are getting flipped and things like that, and the Sandman flies off around the corner down a long street. It was a beautiful shot, I thought.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's hard actually. I mean, I just obviously couldn't tell without looking at plates where the digital and the live action. You know, there was clearly a lot of live action in that shot. I have no idea, for example, in some of those cars, whether they were fully in camera or not. And it really is pretty hard to tell on a shot of this, a shot of that magnitude in a film of this quality.
Yeah. Well, and I will say too that to me it held up very well in IMAX because I've seen it both now in IMAX and the smaller standard screen, and it held up well. I was impressed at that. Not a lot of
Yeah.
movies always do that.
I saw 300 on IMAX and I found it quite kind of, was it like, was less enjoyable than seeing it normally because I couldn't take in what was going on. It was sort of too much in your face.
Right.
But you found this okay, did you?
Yeah, no, I tend to sit further back in IMAX. I learned that early on because I actually saw Spider-Man 2 in IMAX and sat a little too close. And some of the other films, I've learned that you want to sit further back in IMAX for traditional films that are taken to IMAX. And you can get that grander scope, and it also you can focus better on the visual effects for it. So.
Well, the other thing is there's a sweet spot in 35 for sort of the center of the frame, and there's a sort of a sweet spot for IMAX, which is actually sort of the lower third. And so it really isn't, if you talk to like a DOP who does, you know, IMAX cinematography, it isn't necessarily framed exactly the same. So and it doesn't feel like the same aspect ratio because this was a 2:4 like, you know, widescreen film. So on an
Right.
IMAX, wouldn't it, you've lost something left and right? I don't.
Yeah, I think you did when, at least thinking back to when I saw it versus IMAX versus the standard screen, I do think it felt like it was a differently framed picture in some ways too. So,
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure it was like 2:4:1 in the cinema. I remember thinking it was pretty widescreen and stuff. And what do you think of the grade of the whole film, the actual look of it?
It looked different in some ways to the other ones. The overall look I thought was good for the film. The one thing that was interesting to me is that talking about the character not necessarily always looking good at the beginning, the Spider-Man character sometimes early on didn't quite fit the rest of the image to me always. Now I don't know if that was because they wanted it to, or if it was just because the look overall, but sometimes the early Spider-Man CG stuff didn't quite match for me always.
Because the I remember around the time of Spider-Man 2, they were talking about the grading. They really set up sort of color arcs and palette arcs. But in this film, they had a quite a complicated sort of, because effectively there were four villains, weren't there? There was like really evil Spidey, the new Goblin, the Sandman,
Venom.
and Venom. So, you know, normally you'd sort of a bit like audio, you'd choreograph different sounds and different looks for their different scenes, but that was quite a lot going on in terms of just inter sort of connected plots and stuff. And I found the color arcs less obvious in this film than in the previous one.
Most definitely. The one sequence where I did notice them doing some darkening or some changing of it was more with the Harry Osborn character when he was almost doing that kind of internal battle going between is he going to listen to this voice of his dead father or, you know, fighting with his almost morality of trying to help his friends.
What did you think about the alley fight with Harry Osborn's character? You know, the that was a Spider Camry going through those narrow buildings and stuff.
Sometimes I felt the motion was almost too fast and I couldn't really tell what was going on.
I had that, yeah. I had that sort of like, wasn't that it was bad visual effects, it's just that I was like, I don't know, overwhelmed by the number of cuts and couldn't orientate myself where I was.
Yeah, there were several parts where I couldn't tell if they were quite falling, you know, if their momentum was pulling them forward or if they're falling towards the street level. That was hard to tell sometimes in some of those in the fights where they're grappling sometimes. So, that was, yeah, definitely disorienting.
Because they had this physics-based ballistics tool they were using to allow animators to work out the center of mass of the characters and stuff, which I presume would have been most useful in those shots where he was effectively balancing on the board. But I don't know. It's just it wasn't that that was wrong for me. It was just that it was like what is up and what is down, and if I can't kind of work out where it's coming from, and it's just an assault on the senses, then it's somehow less threatening because you kind of give up and go, well, whatever. And I wonder if that's me, if I'm getting too old, or if it's just that we just want that to be faster and faster and quicker, and it just never stops.
No, I think I felt the same thing. And actually, my friend who I went with the second time felt that same thing too. It was very disorienting in that sequence sometimes. So,
And so do you think they'll have a Spider-Man 4?
Well, from some of the things I've been reading is that Raimi really only wanted it to be a 3-movie arc, but I know Sony wants it to be a much larger one. The question in my mind will be whether if Raimi only wanted it to be a 3-movie arc, if the actors would come back for a 4th movie.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that you could replace Spidey, and yet, you know, they did it to their detriment with Batman, didn't they? They just kept on swapping lead roles in that franchise until it faded out. I mean, it got reborn, of course, but it was quite an expensive degradation of the franchise there for a while. By the time you had George Clooney doing all kinds of stupid things.
Oh, yeah, no, it definitely. I mean, the new Batman I found very compelling, but definitely if they try doing the same thing with the Spider-Man franchise where they keep swapping actors out, I think they're just going to kill their own franchise.
Yeah, it must be extremely difficult. I mean, with something like the Harry Potter series, you knew that there was going to be, you know, effectively 7 books. You could, you know, age the characters and the actors knew what they were kind of buying in films in for. But, I mean, you really couldn't imagine when you're signing up for Spidey 1 that it'd go past 3 films. And certainly, you know, I mean, I felt bad for Sigourney when she tried doing Aliens 4. It was just like, you know, an alien too far.
Well, exactly. I mean, and I'm a huge fan of the Alien series, but And I mean, I can see them doing one, but it would probably have to be done by Ridley Scott again or Cameron, in my opinion.
My big problem with any of these things is that at some point with the franchise, once you've had the character threatened so many ways, I get to a point anyway where I just don't feel a lot of threat. I mean, it's like, you know what? They're going to survive. They're going to be all right. We've done all this before. They never get eaten, beaten, you know, tossed or killed. So, you know, and certainly in this case, they've pushed that love angle pretty hard. So you can't, you know, really imagine another film written out of another, you know, will she, won't she kind of love thing. So it's almost, you know, if Spidey isn't going to die, then do I really get that kind of into the film? Whereas, I must admit, I said this recently on another podcast, my thing that I love about heroes is that they have so many characters that I believe that they could kill one of my favorite characters off and the series would still go on. And so whenever one of their characters gets into peril, I actually really worried, oh my God, I hope this guy's contract isn't up and they're going to end him from the series.
Right. Well, even Battlestar is kind of that same way, that though some of the newer shows have put drama in it by killing off a character, you wouldn't expect them to kill off always.
Well, that was the thing they did with Starbuck in Battlestar. You're a keen Battlestar watcher?
Oh, yeah. I love Battlestar.
So did you buy that they'd killed off Starbuck?
No, I haven't necessarily bought that. So,
because they removed her name from the front credits and removed her from the, you know, all sort of publicity type stars of the show in an effort to try and convince fans she was dead.
Yeah.
Though, of course, she isn't, as we saw in the finale. But I thought that was a valid attempt to try and, you know, actually buy in some drama.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, they tried hard, but I think there was just too much with that character that you're like, that's too pivotal of a character for them to kill off for too long.
Did you listen to the Battlestar Galactica podcast?
I have a couple times. I haven't listened to it lately, but I have listened to it.
Because this is the funniest anecdote in a podcast ever. In that episode, where I'm a completely, I think we call this a rat hole, but completely in that zone when they were killing off Starbuck. I don't know if you remember, but the lead character, Adama, at the end of that episode is putting the final touches to his model ship. And he's so upset about her leaving that he smashes the ship. Do you remember this at the end of, it was like second or third last ep of the series. Anyway, there's this big, you know, traditional wooden model ship, gorgeously made, that he smashes up. Well, apparently what happened behind the scenes is they hadn't actually told the actors that they weren't getting rid of the actress that was playing Starbuck. So they were genuinely upset. I mean, only the writers knew, right? And when they filmed that, they thought, well, let's not tell anyone so that there's, you know, genuine emotion that somebody is leaving the cast and everyone's really upset. Seems like a reasonable thing to do, right?
Right.
Except for the fact that the scene was never scripted that he would smash that yacht. He was just so upset that they'd killed off this character and an actress who he really liked working with, that he really was caught in the emotion of the moment and decided that he would just creatively take the decision as an actor to smash that prop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was a rented $100,000 antique prop.
Oh, no.
Ronnie Moore talks about this in his podcast. It was insured, right? But literally three art department people were standing to one side. He did the take where he smashed it, and they all just, like, choked. And it was like, if we knew he was going to smash it, we'd have got a prop one. But this was like a real antique we'd got in. And, of course, later they were like, okay. Yeah, not so good with the smashing. And, oh, by the way, she hasn't actually left the show. But, you know, Emmy Award-winning performance for emotional kind of reaction to character's demise there. Thanks, sir. Thanks for that.
Most definitely.
Oh, and I mean, the acting in that show is terrific. You know, it was just really, really good. So I guess you can't complain, but mistakes do happen even on the largest budget, most well-organized productions.
Oh, most definitely.
Were there any moments in this film that got you emotionally, that you were like just totally sitting on the edge of your seat rooting for what was going to happen? Or
I did like the ending of the film. I didn't at first. I was like, I don't know if I like this, but in general I liked the ending of the film. I thought they did a good job with, you know, killing Harry off a bit. I mean, it was kind of could see it coming, but I thought it was a good turn of, you know, bringing Harry in to help out and then having him die off in the end.
So looking ahead to the other summer blockbusters that it's going to be up against, what's on your hit list of Friday or Saturday night movies to go and see?
Well, I'm definitely going to go see Pirates. I've been a fan of that series, so I will definitely go see the next one.
I must admit, Harry Potter, it would be my wife's favorite, and Pirates would be mine.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to both of those.
I will say, I just saw the trailer for the new Harry Potter, and it looks spectacular. I mean, it looks like they've really amped up the effects for it, and it's going to have some great scenes in it.
Yeah, I definitely think we should do a podcast over that one, because there's a lot in a Harry Potter film, and as there are in obviously in Pirates. So it'll be good to have a look at those. And are you of that generation that actually grew up thinking Transformers were cool, or are you in that generation that were like, yeah, not so much?
I grew up in the generation where Transformers were cool, but I was into Japanese anime and Robotech, which is kind of where that seemed to come from, well before Transformers. So when Transformers came out in the US, I was like, they just ripped off my really great Japanese anime. So
I must admit, the trailer looks good. I think ILM's done a really good job, but it wasn't one that I was like, put it this way, it's not as bad as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which, you know, I was almost like, who do I sue that they made this into a film?
Yeah.
But yes, I think Pirates is much more my cup of tea.
Yeah. I will say there's one that I've shown the trailer to a couple people, and they've all been like really excited to see it. And it's the movie Sunshine.
Oh, right. Well, that's opened here. It hasn't opened in the US, but it's open in Australia and in England.
Oh, really? Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't realize that, I guess.
Yeah, so we actually have something on FX Guide about it, actually.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll have to go check that out, I guess.
It's one of those curious occasions. The only other one I can remember in recent times was Children of Men, where we got it way ahead of the US. But, it was definitely... we have a story about it. It was like MPC that did 750 shots for that.
Wow.
Yeah. It's...
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, yeah, that was one I've kind of been anticipating. I hadn't realized it had been released internationally yet, so...
It's not really, I don't think, a big budget film, mm-hmm. but it's got some very... what's really gorgeous rendering of the sun. Mm-hmm. And definitely from a visual effects point of view, that's pretty interesting. But yeah, no, it's... it's definitely one that's on the radar. There just is so many films coming out this time of year, aren't there?
Oh yeah, there's a ton. I know that Shrek the Third just did big business here. I think it was the third highest grossing opening of all time. So
yeah, well, you know, Shrek happens.
Yeah,
I guess the other thing that I'm always looking forward to is any Pixar film, and Ratatouille. I don't care who does a Pixar film. From now until the day I die, I'm going to go see them because I think they're great.
I totally agree. That one looks like it will be a really good movie, too. I remember that was it. Aardman came out with their mouse film, was it last year? And it was, I thought, okay. But Ratatouille looks really good.
Yeah. What is it about? Because if you look at traditional animation, again, this would be a pun to say a rat hole, but there's been two rat films, but then there were two ants films. There were a series of films of which there were two, you know, within a year of each other.
Right.
And it's just hard to believe that somebody doesn't think that's a bad idea or maybe it's deliberate and maybe they just think that the audience can't get enough of it and it's a good time to cash in.
Well, it almost feels almost to me like there's a lot of times where somebody's working at Pixar and they leave and go somewhere else and they'll say, well, what are you working on? I'm not really supposed to tell you, but it has something to do with fish or it has something to do with ants or, you know, or bugs. And it seems like they do.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And you'd think that, you know, given the amount of money involved, that you'd be like, yeah, not so much. But time in, time again, they do it. But look, we've probably reached the end of this week's recording. Thank you so much for joining us and helping swell our numbers. We have various members in various parts of the world and a few that have got big projects on and won't be able to be with us for a while. But I'm nervous to say we'll see you next week because I'm not quite sure when we're recording again. But
Well, maybe you will. I know Alex is still gallivanting around Africa, so it sounds like he's doing quite well there and working on some projects there. So
how about we have a chat about pirates? Because I certainly think we're both looking forward to that.
Most definitely. Yeah, sounds like a plan.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kenji. Thank you guys for listening to us again this week. I'm Mike Seymour on behalf of the Pixel Core crew, and that goes to especially our guys behind the scenes like Stephen and Sean, who do our research and stuff. We want to thank those guys for being tremendous contributors. I'm sure you're the same, Kenji, that just a bunch of people that enable these things that are just so vital behind the scenes.
Oh, there are most definitely a crew of people that are always busy at work.
Until we catch you guys next week, keep it real.